I gave a sermon, actually, it's been twice here, I've given a sermon like this on Waters of Chaos. And we discussed the ways that the Bible uses the untamed waters as a symbol for the world's chaos, and which is, takes a lot of different forms, but just chaos over which God has control, but he's chosen not to solve all those problems right now. He hasn't yet put an end to it. And we also talked about different sea monsters that appear in the Bible, the Tanin and the Nakash and these different words, and that the seas represented the unknown, just as in these pictures here, that you got these sea creatures. And they're dragons, they're sea monsters, they're dragons. And humans have always had a bit of a feeling about, you know, what we can't see and what we can't know. Leviathan or Leviathan is one that appears in the Bible, and it's symbolic of the thing of that unknown and so forth. Here, this is back 1865, Gustave Doré. I'm reading a book right now that has that picture in it. And also people that were opposed to what God was doing, or nations that are opposed. Pharaoh is called a monster. He's called a Tanin, a sea monster. Now, he's not a sea monster. He doesn't have scales, but you know that's the way it's used. Nebuchadnezzar swallowed me like a monster. You know, because he was opposed. He was God's tool to deal with the tribe of Judah, but you know it's still he's opposed to God. The world's governments are, you know, in Daniel and Revelation, represented by beasts that come up out of the seas, out of these seas. And Jesus walked on the water. What does that, you know, it shows a lot of things, but it showed that he had control. He had control over all of that. And I have said that it's my personal opinion that new heaven and new earth with no more seas, referring to the chaos. It's going to be an end of the chaos. Actually, this book that had that picture in it, I'm reading the book, it goes, it said the same thing. Said that's what that author in particular said, that this verse has to do with. And then more recently, I gave a sermon that in him is no darkness at all, talking about darkness being another symbol of things that God hasn't taken control of actively in a sense right now. In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 5, it says that in God, you know, he's light and there's no darkness in him at all. So again, darkness is what's opposed to God. We looked at in Hebrew, the darkness has to do with just day and night, like it could, but it's also figuratively used as a contrast between good and evil, or a life that's unenlightened by God, walking in darkness, as it were, not knowing what we're talking about. You can be dark, you know. He says to Job, like, you're in darkness. You don't know what you're saying. And also refers to punishment and destruction sometimes. In the and the ultimate darkness is death. You know, it's dark. It's dark in the ground. It's dark in a casket or a sarcophagus in Egypt or whatever. We looked at the Greek, and I mentioned it's skotia, which is that molding that's underneath the stairs. And it has to do with being obscure or darkness again in classical Greek. But in the Bible, it talks more about darkness as being not darkness itself, but the effect of it. What is life like if we're in the condition of darkness? And, you know, as I mentioned, when you go to a cave and if you turn out all the lights, that's what it is, dark. You can't see anything. You can't, if you haven't done it, you can't see the hand in front of your face. You really can't. It's just an amazing thing. And also pointed out that unlike, I shouldn't say unlike chaos, because the monsters can do stuff, I guess. They're active. But darkness actually has an active part to it, in that it causes blindness. It does something to us. Darkness is not passive, all right? So we looked at that, and Jesus talked about, Jesus said to them, for a little while longer the light is among you, walk while you have the light, so darkness will not overtake you. So not only can darkness give us blindness. So it's not passive, it's active in that way, but it can take over. It can take over what we have. And that's rather amazing too. And Paul pointed out that our struggle isn't against flesh and blood, but it's against the rulers, it's against the powers, it's against the world forces of darkness, okay? We struggle, and it has to do with darkness. Against the spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. So it's a dark world out there, but it's controlled by these heavenly forces. And this is just an example. We have so much information that comes our way, and it's all inspired by dark. It's inspired by darkness. Darkness is in control of it. That doesn't mean everything in any source of information is dark, but it's under the control of that. It's not God's world at this point. And what do we do? Well, we have to come out of that. We have to leave the darkness and walk into the light. As this, if you look, it's kind of like an arrow. You're walking into the light. So we saw in those two sermons how, you know, Genesis recounts how God brought order to the world. And he did it by separating the seas from the land. We have land that he could work with. He also made light. That was first. It could have gone in the other order. Let there be light. And I told Nathan a joke. I'll tell you, take some time. I'm going to interrupt. Saw a cartoon. It had God, you know, the old man God, right? And then it had a table with some other people sitting there. People, the angels. Angels sitting there. I guess they were in, didn't identify them. But God is like thinking, you know, I'm a big picture guy. I say let there be light. You all figure out whether it's a wave or a particle. I thought, some of you will think it's funny anyway. I did. That's what I learned in physics. Anyway, what we didn't go through yet, we talked about waters of chaos, we talked about darkness, but we didn't talk about wilderness yet. I mentioned that wilderness is another way the Bible points to part of, in particular, our earth that God hasn't fashioned into an Eden yet. It's still something he hasn't taken direct control of in the sense of making it right. So today what I'd like to talk about in this sermon is wilderness. It's the wilderness. We haven't talked about it yet. If you like titles, A Journey Through the Wilderness. So, as I did before, I want to look at Hebrew, I want to look at the Greek, and first we'll look at the Hebrew. Wilderness is almost always, I didn't check every single time, but if you see wilderness in English, it's in there several hundred times, but it's Midbar. It's Midbar, and it means it's translated wilderness usually. Occasionally, it's translated desert, and it's used to describe three types of land or country, all right? Pasture land, they say, well, that doesn't sound right. That's not a wilderness, but there's a reason, because there's pasture lands for animals, not for people, all right? And large areas of land in which there are oases or cities and towns, here and there and maybe somewhere else, but overall it's more like a wilderness. Those the words used like that. But it also refers to, and it really this ties all in with the other two, is an uninhabited land. A land where there aren't people. There's no civilization. There's no structure and order to it because man hasn't gone in there and done it. God hasn't gone in there and done it. And that's the one we'll be concerned with this when we're talking about wilderness, the way the theme. And the reason I talk about this is because it's a theme that goes through the whole Bible. Just as waters of chaos goes through the whole Bible, just as darkness, that theme goes all the way through the Bible, so does wilderness. And they all tie together. We'll get into some of the ways that they do. As I said, sometimes the word is translated desert, but mostly it's translated wilderness. And it's referring to a place where people aren't, all right? Even pasture land, you say, well, that's not desert. No, but it's a place where people don't necessarily live. It's where the animals are. And, you know, Saudi Arabia is a huge desert. It's a wilderness, but there are cities. There are cities here and there, and there are oases and so forth. In Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 29 and verse 31, get an idea here. Why do you contend with me? You have all transgressed against me, declares the Lord. O generation, heed the word of the Lord. Have I been a wilderness to Israel or a land of thick darkness? Now, I've just put this in there because in just those two verses that are very close to one another, God's using both darkness and wilderness in a negative way, where Jeremiah's writing it down that way, that, you know, darkness and wilderness is something, you know, that doesn't represent God. And that God, in a way, is justifying himself to Israel, saying, have I been a wilderness or have I been darkness? You know, I haven't done that. So that's the way it's used in the Bible. And, excuse me, and just like the waters of chaos, just like the sea monsters and so forth, it all has similar usage to point out the same kinds of things. So if we go back to the beginning, we got the Garden of Eden, right? And there's a serpent. And the serpent is a representative of what? The garden? No. It's a representative of the wilderness. All right, so the serpent's there in the garden, but the serpent's not from the garden. And the serpent, as we pointed out before in the other sermon, is a nakash. All right, it's one of those words. And the serpent is a resident of the wilderness. So in this case, who had the home field advantage? Adam and Eve or the nakash? Adam and Eve did. They were in the garden. It was their garden where God had put them. The serpent was out of his ken, if you want to say. He was in the garden. God allowed that, but that wasn't his territory. His territory was the wilderness. And right at the beginning, we start to see that it says God sent them out of the garden. Why? Because they had sinned. To cultivate the ground from which Adam was taken. And he drove the man out, and at the east of the Garden of Eden stationed cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned in every direction to guard the tree of life. So Adam and Eve, on our behalf, on behalf of all humanity, chose, nah, I don't want to live in the garden. I want to go out. I want to go to the east. All right, I want to go get out into the wilderness. I want to live there. And so it's been ever since. But it's a progressive thing. And the Bible in Genesis makes the point that it doesn't get better, it gets worse. And Cain is, you know, he kills Abel and then he's cursed. And God says, when you cultivate the ground, it won't yield its strength to you. You'll be a vagrant and a wanderer in the earth. All right, so he's going to be out. Not only is he, you know, he's already been out to the east of Eden, because that's where his parents were, but it says Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So he's getting further out. And anybody know what Nod's? I forgot if I ever knew, but what does Nod mean in Hebrew? It's wandering. You know, so you know, that's the whole point, is that Cain, he's out. Away, he's a wanderer now, all right. And we have decided, as humans, you know, we've decided to do our own thing and do it apart from God's blessing, and we've chosen to do it in the serpent's home territory. We've decided to go into the wilderness to do our thing, not in the garden. When we get to Egypt, it's interesting to how it all works together. I'll stop and just say it now. I've been working on some things that I'm going to be speaking about at the Feast of Tabernacles. And the book I'm reading has to do with Exodus. But the Exodus theme, as we talked the last time I was here and I'm writing all over the whiteboard here, the themes of the Exodus go through the entire Bible. And they go in different people's lives. And it's amazing. And the more I dig, the more it's there. And all the holy days, by the way, have to do with the Exodus, not just one. It's an amazing thing. So much where my brain is, and you'll hear that here some of the time. But we go back to Egypt, and it says Moses and Aaron, this is what Moses was told to say when he went and saw Pharaoh. And, you know, I don't know that Moses was pointing his finger like Charlton Heston was and all that, but, you know, I grabbed this picture. Thus says the Lord, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. Oh, Does that make you think, if you're like me, always asking questions, like, all right, so the wilderness is a bad place. That's where the devil is. That's his territory. God, you know, but God says, I want my people to leave Egypt and go to the wilderness to worship me. That might seem like, how do you balance that? How do you balance that? The sense, though, is that this word has to do with where there aren't people. It's not inhabited. It's away from the Egyptian civilization, which we know from Unleavened Bread represents sin and a way of life that's opposed to God. And to properly worship, Israel was told to ask Pharaoh that they can get out of there, get away from there, and go into the wilderness, go where there aren't people, where the civilization that was opposed to God was not there. So the wilderness here is that it's not that they would go and be able to, you know, go out where Satan is. That wasn't the point. The point is need to go there to get away from this structured and organized sinful society. When they got out, and this is like right after they got out, they're just going through the sea. And, you know, they don't have water, they don't have food, they don't have this, they don't have that. They said to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've chosen to take us out away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us this way? So the people who wrote the Bible, they knew what they were doing. They're really good writers. God inspired them to be good writers. And this is an example of it. You think, you just read this and say, okay, you can read the narrative. It says, have you taken us out to die in the wilderness? But wilderness is associated with death. So is darkness, right? So are the sea monsters. You know, all these themes that carry through, they're associated with death. So the Israelites were saying, why don't you just let us die where we were? You brought us out here, we're going to die. So they are choosing, and the first generation did choose this, to die in the wilderness because God didn't let them in. He told them, you know, all the people of a certain age, they were going to die and their children were going to go in. So it's interesting the way it was worked out. But wilderness here, in this case and other cases, is associated with death. All right, just as we learn with darkness and with the waters of chaos. So once they're on their way out, then we read about that goat that we associate with the Day of Atonement from Leviticus 16. And I'm not going to spend any time here, but just point out that Aaron will lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it the iniquities of the sons of Israel. Anybody know what this is, by the way? I see these all the time in my regular commute. Huh? Is it what? Trash truck, yeah, they're hauling trash from down where I live up to Pennsylvania and dump it in the landfills up here. Yeah, there's a lot of those coming out of Maryland coming up here. I see them all the time. Anyway, and Aaron was to lay his hands on this goat, and the goat was going to take all the sins, that's what I'm represented by the trash truck here, take all the sins out into the wilderness, get them away from the camp. But here's wilderness, it's... Again, it's a negative thing. If you're going to have sins, let's just send them out there. Let's send them out there. But the wilderness is separate from the camp of Israel. Camp of Israel's, they're all in the wilderness, but you have at least an area where the Israelites are, and that has its own civilization, if you want to call it that, even though it's mobile, it's moving around. And you go outside of the camp to do certain things, including sending the sins out on the Day of Atonement, figuratively. In Hebrews 3, you're reading Hebrews now, that's a whole lot of references back to the Exodus. You've already been through most of those. It says, who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, didn't all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Wasn't he angry with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And you can read Psalm 78, Psalm 95, a lot of different psalms, Ezekiel 20. These themes that you have just recently read in the book of Hebrews. They come from different books in the Hebrew scriptures. But Hebrews describes Israel's exodus from Egypt as a journey through the wilderness, a journey through the wilderness. And that's, of course, what it was. They were going to a land of promise, but they had to go, they were leaving a place that, you know, where God's presence wasn't, but they had to go through a wilderness to get to where they were going. And that's, of course, the story of the Exodus, and it's through the whole Bible. We go to Greek, get into the what we call the New Testament. This word is arimos. I can't read Greek, but that's what it says. It's arimos, or, yeah. Yeah, the accent on the first part. And the root of that word is abandonment, abandoning something. And that matters because, in general, it refers to a place without inhabitants, kind of like the Hebrew word did, a place where people aren't there. There's no social structure. There's no people. It's also used in other ways, but you'll see they're all related to this. It could mean sometimes it's a lonely place. But why is it lonely? Because there aren't people there. Sometimes it could be a place that's been devastated. That word is used for a place that's been wiped out. Again, for the same reason, because it's a place without inhabitants now. So that's what we'll focus on that for a little bit here. John the Baptist. Trying to give you some background here to wilderness. John the Baptist came preaching in the wilderness of Judea. So that's where he preached. He preached in an area that didn't have a whole lot of people living there. And he said, "Repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand." For this is the one referred to by Isaiah the prophet when he said, "The voice of one," this is Jesus saying, or I'm sorry, this is Matthew saying, you were talking about John the Baptist, and he was mentioned in Isaiah. He's going to be the voice of crying out in the wilderness. Crying in the wilderness. So John the Baptist, the one we call John the Baptist, was prophesied. And he was prophesied to be a son of the wilderness in a way. He lived in the wilderness and he preached in the wilderness. He's a little bit different. But that's what he was associated with, because he wasn't around a lot of people until he was preaching to them. When Jesus, we've gone through this before, but when Jesus was baptized, the first thing that's mentioned in Matthew after he was baptized is that the Spirit led him up into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And he fasted 40 days, 40 nights, and became very hungry, of course. So Jesus faced the devil down. And where did he do it? He did it in the wilderness. Who had the home field advantage this time? The devil did. It was the devil's territory. Says the devil took him up, where their vision, however this is happening, he took him here, took him there. This is the devil gets to do this. And of course Jesus wasn't tempted. He wasn't buying it. In Matthew chapter 14, this is the wilderness kind of in a good way. And it's not just Matthew 14, it's all over the New Testament. After he had sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When it was evening, he was there alone. Jesus went off into the wilderness. In Luke 5, it says Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. He needed to get away from the crowds. I think I've mentioned before, Mark says it a lot. When I was reading that to the kids in the homeschool, it's like Mark saying he got away. He got away. He's always getting away from the crowds because he needed time to himself. It's also, I think, instructive that he did this after he had faced down the devil. So now Jesus, he's exerted a certain amount of control over the spirit world because the disciples could cast out demons and all that. So although the wilderness hasn't, God hasn't fixed all the wilderness, nor the seas, nor the darkness. It's different now because now Jesus has control. He's taken control of that. So when you look at these things, whether it's darkness, whether it's the waters of chaos, or whether it's a wilderness, it's the Bible's way of describing the world not under God's I don't want to say control. God's in control of everything. But he hasn't taken away the bad. You know, that's something we look forward to. That's something in the future. And we're not in the future yet. We're just looking forward to that. So we are in a wilderness of sorts. We're in a society that's not geared, you know, to do what God says and to obey him. So what does all this mean for us? What does this mean for us? What does it mean for you? What does it mean for me? This wilderness. So what? I got a few points. First one being, we all live outside the garden. You know, Adam and Eve made that choice for us. Now we all live outside of the garden. And that decision still stands. God hasn't reversed that. God hasn't changed that. We live in what you could call hostile territory. It's where the devil still reigns. That doesn't mean there's no good out there. And I'm not asking you to wake up in the morning and be in a bad mood because you're in the enemy territory. But that's the way it is. That's the way the Bible presents it. 23rd Psalm that we all probably memorize at some point in our lives, no matter what church we were in as kids. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Well, we all do that. We all do that because we're all walking in the wilderness. You know, it's not always the shadow of death. It's not always life-threatening. But we are in hostile territory. It's not God's world. I wonder about that song. I don't know if it's in the hymn or not. We sing, "This is my Father's world." Well, not really. He's delegated it to the devil for now. He's delegated, you know. Yes, God made a wonderful, beautiful world. We appreciate the creation. We appreciate it. So in that sense, it's definitely true. But the society is not God's. The society is not God's. It's motivated by things that are ungodly. I've, you know, read this one before, and you know the verse in John 17 during his prayer, Jesus' prayer. He says, "I don't ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one." So when you look at it in the big picture of the whole Bible, Jesus is just recognizing the reality here. He says, "Father, I know you haven't taken things over yet. You're not fixing it. And I'm not asking you to take my disciples," that's us too, much later, "out of the world, but keep them from the evil one that's in charge of the world still." And we have that going for us, but I hope we don't forget that it's not God's world. You know, we need help, we need God's help, the Spirit's help, to stay away from and apart from the evil one. Because we're in the wilderness. That's where we are. Adam and Eve made that choice to live outside of the garden. We're still outside of the garden. And we have to live with that. I guess it's easy to be deceived. Sometimes we think we're going to fix, not you personally or me, but as humans we think we can fix this, fix that, and you know we should try to make things better where we have influence, but we can't fix the world. We can't. That time's coming. So first of all, you know, we live in a fallen world. That's right. We're not in the garden. Second point that I have here is that, and this is nothing new. You obviously know these things. We are on our exodus through the wilderness. We are all on a personal exodus, and that's as I study this. The whole idea was studying for some things that again I'm going to speak about in the fall. But the more I read and the more I study, it's all about the Exodus. The theme of the Exodus goes through the entire Bible. From Genesis, which is before the Exodus, chronologically, to Revelation. The themes of the Exodus are there throughout. Salvation is an Exodus. Exodus is a type. The Exodus, as it's portrayed in Exodus and Leviticus, or mostly Exodus and Numbers, but Leviticus and Deuteronomy as well. That's a type of what all Christians, all followers of Jesus, have to do. We have to leave Egypt. We have to be on a personal exodus through the wilderness. And we're on our way to the land of promise. It's everywhere. It's everywhere through the Bible. And it's God's doing. God designed it this way. And the whole Bible is built around it. So, I know I think I've mentioned this before, but and I'm nothing against people that live in enclaves or, you know, whatever the, you would call it. There's another word that I can't, it's not coming to my mind, but where you get off to yourself and you just live in your own little society. If that's what they want to do, if that's what people want to do, that's, you know, I don't have a complaint about that. But the idea of having to live in the devil's world and negotiate that somehow is God's, that's something that God has done. Yes, Adam and Eve made the decision, but God could have had another way of working it out, but he didn't. Because Jesus said, I'm not asking you to take them out of the world. I'm sending them into the world. So God's got a plan that's going to save a lot of people, and it involves us going into the world to do that. You like it or not, that's just the way it is, and that's the way God did it. It's the way he chose to do it. And where we are now is only the middle of the story. We haven't gotten anywhere near the end yet of that story. We're in the middle of it. Back to 23rd Psalm. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I feel no evil. Why? Because you are with me, and your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You know, Israel went through, we'll talk about this more, but Israel went through the Exodus, but God was right there with them. They didn't always appreciate that. Sometimes they fought him, but he was there. He was there. We're on our own personal exodus, both individually and collectively, as Christians throughout the whole world, and each one of us as individuals. We're on that journey through the wilderness. Okay, another one is that on that journey, we have to rely on God's provision. You know, Israel got water from a rock. They got manna. They got quail sometimes. I think I wrote that down. But the wilderness is desolate. This world is desolate spiritually. It doesn't have anything to offer. Now, I'm not saying there aren't Christian people that have something to offer, or, you know, people that are studying and following God that have something to offer us, of course. But as a whole, society can't help us because we're marching through that to go to something else. And that's just the way it is. We don't want to fall too much in love with what's around us. God provided the water, provided the manna, provided quail. So he provides for you, he provides for me. He's given us this journey that we need to go through, that we need to take. But he also gives us the means to survive the journey and prosper in the journey. So that's a wonderful thing. He's done that for us. To survive, we must eat at God's table. Go back to the 23rd Psalm. Next verse. You prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. You've anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Even though we live in the wilderness, even though we are journeying through the wilderness on the way to the land of promise, we can eat at God's table in that, in the midst of that. That's a wonderful thing. And we do it, you know, every day. We also do it, as was mentioned in the opening prayer, we do it every week. We come together, and that's a special time. But as Dan mentioned, it's a daily thing and a weekly thing and a, you know, a holy day, whatever. That happens often, but it's special when we can get together and do that and eat at God's table. But we have to rely on that because that's the only way we'll make it through. And we know from the Bible that the wilderness has an expiration date. It's not going to be there forever. We sang it in one of the songs. I forget which number it was. We sang about the wilderness changing and turned into something glorious. Isaiah 32, you could have looked at a lot of places, but until the Spirit is poured out upon us from on high and the wilderness becomes a fertile field. So the wilderness... We look at that literally. You know, we go to the Feast of Tabernacles and we think about lions and lambs and fruitful fields where there were deserts. I don't have any problem with any of that. But the picture is bigger than that. It's bigger than that. The wilderness becomes a fertile field. The fertile field's considered as a forest. Everything's going to get better, way better. Then justice will dwell in the wilderness. That's not the way it is now. Where's justice? Well, justice is going to dwell in the wilderness. Then my people will live in a peaceful habitation and in secure dwellings and in undisturbed resting places. So yes, we're going through an exodus. We're going through, in a sense, enemy territory, hostile territory. There's plenty of things that could upset you, that could upset me. And this sin should upset us. But we get to eat at God's table on this journey. As Hebrews said, you already read that a few weeks ago, I assume, in Hebrews 3 and 4 and so on, about the people that on the first Exodus. And the Bible talks about a second Exodus. And you could say, in a sense, that's the people of Israel being regathered in the end. But it also refers to you and me and all the people throughout history that are going through their own exodus. And God has ordained that it be that way. And the world to come, the world tomorrow, the promised land, whatever you want to call it, it's got a lot of wonderfully, beautiful physical things that we look forward to. But I think what we need to look forward to more than anything else is that it's going to be a just world. It's going to be a peaceful world. It's going to be a world where God's no longer going to let it be a world of darkness, a world full of sea monsters that are opposing, and a world that's desolate and uninhabited, like the wilderness. We're all on a journey through the wilderness. It's something we all do individually and we do collectively. And that's exactly the way God planned it. So we need to trust Him to get us where we are going. It's the only way.